Okay, we have about 45 minutes for discussion. I'd ask people to keep contributions to around 2 minutes. I will be telling you to end your contribution at 2 minutes, so we can have plenty of time for people to contribute and hear from a wide range of opinions. Do you want to begin with your...
Yeah, sure.
We have actually a couple more people, I think, from the Ruth First Project who were going to begin the discussion by making a few comments, but then we'll open it up for everyone else and we'll then hear from the speakers again. So
I'm not
going to
be interested.
I'm Matt. I'm another researcher on Ruth First Papers Project.
Just speak up, please.
If I might first of all just suggest that there is a very natural bridge between these two papers, and I think it's the question of how kind of issues of self-determination, issues of religion and things that normally get bracketed as cultural rather than economic, how these, at what point in the decolonial process or in the struggle to overcome colonial oppression, these become important. In the context of our reading of Ruth First in her background from Franz Fanon, he has a very clear argument that what happens in the process of a struggle for national liberation is that all of these antagonisms between the different groups who are involved in that struggle are made invisible, and then it's only once the revolution has happened and the national bourgeoisie has taken power that these issues rise again. And in the context of Mozambique, one of our Mozambican colleague talks a lot about the obscurantism of Mozambican indigenous religion, where you can see that his schooling has come from Frelimo and from their particular take on religion, but these issues sound like they have a lot of affinity with the way that you're describing the relationship between the RPP and the indigenous groups in the south of Mindanao. But I'm just going to briefly talk about the Ruth First Papers project and what it is that we actually do. I think Leo's paper highlights quite clearly the difficulties of treating a collection of material like this as a personal archive, a kind of autobiographical archive of an individual's work, as opposed to a collection of material that's around the general issue of decolonisation and the struggle against apartheid. And at the Institute of Commonwealth Studies, we have about a third of Ruth First's papers. We're the only collection which I think is purely in an academic institution, because another part of the collection is in the Centre for African Studies at Eduardo Mondlane University. And that centre was established by Ruth First as a kind of intellectual wing of the Frelimo government. The other part of the collection is in the Maiduye archives in South Africa, which is housed at the University of Western Cape. But again, that's a national struggle archive. And I think it's important that this collection is shared between those institutions, but also in one which has the possibility of asking slightly more critical questions, like the kind that Leo was raising. As well as having the personal collection that belongs to Ruth First, our archive has grown much wider than that through documents from the Centre for African Studies and also people's personal contributions to our archive. I mean, people have just come out of the work and given us material that they find interesting that we've put online. Our periodisation of Ruth's work is biographical. It has to be, because her life divides so neatly into the three into her time in South Africa up until 64, and then her time in the UK, and then her time in Maputo towards the end of her life. But we've tried as much as possible to make the collection not just reflect her own life, but reflect the events that were taking place around the time. So if you go to our website and look at the collection, you'll see that it's organised in clusters of material that are to do with particular events, particular campaigns that were going on. So in her early period, we have material around the Bethel farm labour scandal, about the bus boycott and other similar campaigns. In her middle period, we focus more on the topics that she was writing on rather than on her life itself. And in her late period in Mozambique, we're really interested in what her teaching practices and what kind of work he's actually trying to do in Mozambique in terms of building a class of organic intellectuals. And as Leo said, there is this personal inconsistency in the relationship between her theory and her life. And I think it's probably fair to say that although she was a critic of the two-stage model of revolution, she didn't do away with it entirely. She just modified it in order to make it something that was appropriate to her way of acting. The debate with Archie Mafferji that Leo talks about is an interesting one, because in it she uses, I'm not sure if it's in that one or in another text, but she thinks of three types of revolutionary struggle in the decolonial setting. There's the economic struggle, which is the kind of classical Marxist struggle to overcome the class system that's created by settler colonialism. And then there's what she calls the national struggle, which is the struggle by the national bourgeoisie in order for them to take power and take control of the institutions of colonial power. And that's the kind that Fanon criticises and that she criticises. And then she also refers at times to the true national struggle, which seems in her writing to be something that takes place after the economic struggle has been won. And I think it's fair to say that the way that she theorises it is that she brackets the kind of national struggle, struggle for cultural issues, struggles over religion and ethnicity and race, as something that will happen in the decolonial moment rather than in the process of overcoming colonial oppression. And
there's lots of flyers
over there.
Okay. Thank you. So
that's
Charlie,
did you?
Yeah.
I want to thank both Leo and Pierre for really excellent presentations. And this question is really for Pierre. What you seem to describe with the grouping that you're talking about in Mindanao seems to be a group that has been able to successfully, in some ways, jettison the worst aspects of the Philippine Communist Party's internal bureaucratic authoritarian structure, that is seeking a way to unify all of these various groups, peasant groups, various hunter-gatherer groups, etc., and trying to build a struggle essentially for the preservation of land and forests against capitalist incursion. Now, the question I have for you is that this seems to be a region, and you can correct me, that doesn't have much industry or mining. There's not a very large wage-earning class, a large working class. And to what extent is there the possibility that this grouping is going to reproduce the sort of revolutionary project that you described that the Maoists did in the 20s and 30s and 40s, one which sought to overthrow capitalism, but to bring itself to power on the basis of non-working class social forces, that does, and I know this will be controversial in this room, did overthrow capitalism, but brought to power what can be considered something of a non-capitalist class-like ruling class in China, and to what? So I'm asking, to what extent is that an issue, and to what extent does this grouping have ties with dissident socialist and Marxist groups in other places that have more of a base among the urban working classes, whether industrial or in the service sector, etc.
Yeah.
I'm Ben Cousins. I'm from South Africa, from University of West Cape. Pierre said something interesting. He said, it's easy to say, but not easy to do. What I think he was talking about was how to link class and non-class forms of politics. Well, that's my interpretation of what he was saying. But I want to link that to something that Leah said, which is about what Ruth first didn't do in the end, was to make a more systematic break with Stalinism. I want to link this to a new book which has just come out, by someone called Stephen Ellis on South African politics, in which he alleges that the South African Communist Party runs the ANC from within and has over many decades. And it is, of course, what the politics of the SACP, the Communist Party, has been, which has been to work from within the ANC and try to manipulate it. And I think that's One way in which the SACP has interpreted the task of working with essentially a national liberation movement, and it's a Stalinist practice. So I would suggest to the Ruth First archive that one thing you need to look for is evidence of the kinds of Stalinist politics which the SACP engaged in, and which Ruth First was not able to make a decisive break with. It's a very sensitive issue given the fact that the SACP is still in an alliance with the ANC and still occupies key leading positions. In other words, that politics is alive and well. And I think this difficulty of linking, in South Africa in particular, race issues, politics of race, to issues of class, remains a key obstacle, a key issue which we have not yet learned to do. In other words, the politics which links class to other forms of politics is something we still struggle with.
Thank you. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm Florian Wild from Germany. I want to thank both speakers for this very inspiring contributions. I have questions regarding the Mindanao conflict. First, I'd like to know a little bit more about, like, in numbers, what are we talking about? The RPM, like, how big are they? How many people really follow them? Are they present in other regions of the Philippines, at least in a small scale, or not? And maybe if you have also some numbers about the other left-wing armed forces you were mentioning, just to have a clearer picture about this. And then I'd like to know more about, you said that, and I noticed from before I was reading about this, but I never understood it, how the RPM developed towards Trotskyism or towards the Fourth International. Because they joined, as far as I know, the Fourth International, yeah? How did it came? I mean, we would have expected that after 1989, lots of Maoist or Stalinist groups would break with their traditions and would move over to Trotskyism, but instead we have very, very few cases where this was happening in history. One of the very few cases is Mindanao, so I'm very interested in how did this develop and what does it mean? I mean, are these indigenous people now reading Trotsky's Permanent Revolution, or are they studying Trotsky on culture and literature, or is, like, My Life the bestseller in the Philippines now, or, like, what does it mean in concrete practice of this group? And
how does he become Trotsky, say, I'm not
sure? Yeah, like, if you have for the permission, but just to sum up, I mean, we have some interesting cases, I think, where groups coming from Maoist and Stalinist traditions were breaking with it and developing new styles of very self-emancipation and self-determination-oriented politics. For example, the Zapatistas, which have Maoist roots in Mexico, developed their own style of self-emancipation-oriented politics, which are beautiful but are not linked to historic Trotskyism. The PKK nowadays, at least, is talking about, in the language, is very like council democratic, basis democratic structures, building community from below, and so on. So we have these developments. In no other case, they come to Trotskyism, only in the Mindanao case. So if you have any more information about this, that would be very please.
Comrades, my name is Gavin Capps, and like Ben, I've just come over from South Africa, where, amongst other things, I'm involved in the Marikana support campaign. And I just wanted to say something about the struggle of the mine workers now in South Africa, which Leo may want to respond to through the prism of Ruth First. The strike, really, which in its own way I think we're going to look back on as significant as the 1946 Great Mine Workers' Strike, but hopefully for its victory and not for its defeat. And what is happening in South Africa at the moment is absolutely extraordinary with the mine workers, because particularly centred on the Platinum Belt, but also moving into gold and chrome and other sectors, there's been a revolt, really, against the National Union of Mine Workers, which is dominated by the politics of the South African Communist Party, or rather what the South African Communist Party has degenerated into since 1994. And you're getting this absolutely extraordinary situation where you have workers moving at an incredible rate and speed. And this is no exaggeration, but building real democratic forms of self-organisation. The workers' committees, which have been springing up through Lonmin, through Impala, through Anglo Platinum, through Goldfields South Africa, through Anglo Gold Ashanti, are absolutely incredible. And they're incredibly democratic, they're incredibly disciplined, and they know what they're doing. And standing against that, you have the leader of the South African Communist Party, Bladen Zamandi, calling these people counter-revolutionaries and calling on the security forces of the South African state to crush the strike. and they were calling on the forces of the South African state to crash the strike, actually in the build-up to the massacre at Marikana itself, where 34 mine workers were murdered, so at least 16 of them shot in the back and shot in the back of the head, 78 further injured, 270 rounded up, arrested, tortured, and then charged with the murder of their colleagues. And it's really, really reached a crucial point in South Africa now, because the politics of the post-1994 settlement and the ability of the trade union bureaucracy, like England, linked into the tripartite alliance to keep the working class under control, that now has been decisively pushed against, and that has been decisively threatened. So how Ruth First might have thought about this and might have responded to it, it would be interesting to hear from Leo.
Thanks.
But for yourselves, we need to raise money for the South African mine workers. We need to make sure they can win this strike.
Thank you.
Just a question for Pierre Housset, which perhaps rather carries on from the two questions in the back there. Pierre mentioned these clan conflicts, bloody ones, within the Muslim communities. That clearly indicates that there's very profound social and economic transformation needs to take place within that community. And I wonder what the my comrades in the group whose name I now forget, but the comrades there are proposing or are putting forward in terms of social economic transformation in the Muslim community. And perhaps if I could just ask a very, very, very quick one to you on Ruth First. Her single revolution sounds remarkably like Trotsky's permanent revolution. Did Ruth First actually know his work? Did she refer to it? Did she work with it? Or did she keep that suppressed because of her CP connections?
Thank you. Andy?
Yeah, I mean, I feel I sent it in. There's a TV program called... I went into a parallel universe here, basically. I mean, I'm really disturbed about some of the discussion.
Can you speak up, please?
I'm really disturbed in this parallel universe about the history and contribution of Ruth First. I mean, Ruth First responded in a very progressive direction as a privileged white person. Her response was prefigured by the Africanist movement inside South Africa itself. This wasn't just about responding to Fanon in books. There was a real working class Pan-Africanist movement inside South Africa itself. And I find it remarkable that one can write about this solely framed right here. I don't think she would have such insensitivity, to be honest with you, right? The connection between Nkrumah and Maputo and Ruth First is the mines, right? I mean, there's no doubt about it. The specificity of a combination of race and class in South Africa goes through the mine industry completely. And we need to look at that. And Ruth First did look at that, and she contributed enormously to it. And it's kind of like, I don't know, you seem to be positing the idea that it's somehow Stalinist by definition or irrational to support national liberation as a struggle on the way to socialism. I am not a Stalinist. I completely support that concept, right? I think Ruth First was not a Stalinist, and I think she completely lived that concept, actually, right? And it wasn't a one stage. It's an organic process, but not one stage, if you like. That's a dialectical relationship. And you can see it's not in her head. It was in reality. I mean, the peasants in Mozambique had to become workers in South Africa, right? National liberation against Portuguese had to be a stage, right? Unless and until South Africa was free, right? She didn't invent this stage, right? It's there in the very relationship. And also, there's a real sort of thing going on here, which by national liberation struggles, by definition, intrinsically, have to end up with this petty bourgeois, national bourgeoisie and so on. It's not true at all. And you can't elide, right, Libya with Mozambique under Samora Machel. And you did do that, and that's actually the whole crux of the argument. There are different paths out of the guerrilla struggle as well as into it.
Thank you. Aziz?
Yeah, I'm talking about parallel universes. I wanted to ask Pierre a couple of questions because there's been a lot of talk about warring clans and stuff in Mindanao now, but you didn't mention at all the US military presence in the Philippines, or in fact the role of the paramilitaries or the government basically killing a lot of activists from a lot of the organisations that are supposed to be aligned with, well, they're accused of being aligned with the CPP or the NDF and so on. And I just found it remarkable that you didn't talk about the fact that notwithstanding the fact that theoretically the base has got kicked out, especially since 9/11, there's been a fairly significant U.S. military presence, to say the least, in the southern Philippines. So, you know, I don't know whether you want to call them warring tribes or whatever, but I mean the U.S. military is very much kind of in there, boots and all.
Okay, I've got two more people down, and then we'll hear from our speakers, and we'll have a chance for another round. So, yes.
It's not really a question, it's just a comment. It's actually when Jamie was talking. It's a fact the use of this term tribes or groupings has, and Pierre was right when he was cautioned about using it, but it's something that has started to be used much more in large areas of the world. For example, in Iraq, you know, the descriptives now are about tribes. They never were 20 years ago. They weren't 15 years ago. And it's something that Palestinians, suddenly there are tribes we're describing, you know. They're not, I mean, it's almost like, I suppose my question is, this is a use of a category, which certainly 10 years ago, 15 years ago, we would never have used. And they are increasingly being used to describe what? Is it in fact families? Is it about power groups? Is it about different ethnicities, which may very well be in the Philippines? But it certainly isn't, for example, in Iraq, you know. And yet these are now terms that are part and parcel of a political dialogue. Maybe not on the left for us, but it is there when we're having to confront them.
Thank you. Did you want to say something?
Yeah, I just had a... It actually connects very closely to previous questions.
Can you speak up?
What I wanted to ask is whether you can specify somewhat more the relationship between the group in Mindanao and the New People's Army and the activities of the FPN. That's all.
Okay. Thank you. I would ask our speakers to keep to 4 minutes each, and then we'll have enough time for another round.
Okay, so I'm going to ask if I can speak for 30 minutes to come back with all those questions. I'll try and be as quick as possible. I think Ben's point is a very good one. I mean, there was also a point in Pierre's presentation about the easy to say, not so easy to do, which I think might also apply to some of the things that I've said and perhaps even some of the criticisms that I've made about Ruth. I'm going to attempt to defend my thesis. I think the debate with Archie Mafferjis is a really interesting one. It's interesting because I think the defence of the SACP and the ANC is at least half of Ruth's response. And it's very sophisticated the way that she does it. So she argues for on the question of the two-stage theory of revolution, it's actually Ruth First stating categorically that this is a concept which we have to move past. Doesn't work anymore, doesn't fit. You know, and that in its place we have to see the struggle, which is implicit in the work that Ruth does, on the role of capitalist investment, the development of capitalism within South Africa, to an understanding of the struggle, the national struggle, which is important, as being a single fight against capitalism and for socialism. But I think that she maintains an understanding of the national struggle as a sort of cold war. And in it is the class struggle and the fight for socialism. And she does that in articles up until the late 70s that she co-authors with Joe Slover, her husband, and a leading figure in the SACP. I think partly as a way of bridging this problem that the SACP is facing theoretically, and also to maintain, find a way of maintaining that alliance with the ANC. What you have to remember about Ruth is that she was an extraordinarily loyal defender of those organisations that she maintained. One of the reasons, no doubt, that she makes that final move to Mozambique in the late 70s is because it's also a base for the ANC activities, where she wants to be involved as an activist. I mean, there was a big debate at the start of our project about whether or not we could talk about Ruth First, the revolutionary writer, scholar. In fact, her daughter, Gillian Slova, who's on our advisory board, said Ruth would hate the idea that she was a scholar. She was an activist. You know, this sense of her as being, sense of activism being at the centre of everything that she did. Gavin's point, I think, is absolutely central for two reasons. One, that as I illustrated, that Ruth was transformed into a revolutionary and to a Marxist because of her participation, not because of books that she read, but her participation in the 46 strike. I think what's exciting about South Africa, the way that Gavin described it, is that a new generation among a whole range of communities is being transformed in a similar way today. And that's extraordinarily exciting, but it's even more profound because it's outside that the stranglehold of Stalinist organisations and the potential of that to come from outside. The Archie, I've got to say, I'm not going to be maybe causing another controversy, but I actually think Archie's argument in 1970 is much more interesting than Ruth's in many ways. One of the things he says in it is that organisations that exist will not die naturally. They have to be taken on and confronted. And his worry about that Soweto generation who goes into exile, you know, through the SACP and ANC, is that they weren't able to use those organisations for their own purposes, their own political training, but in fact were shaped fundamentally by the politics of them. We now have this incredibly exciting possibility in South Africa for a new generation to emerge and develop themselves through working class struggle participation in the strike wave that Gavin talks about. I'd like to say, just to supplement what Gavin mentioned, there's a stall outside. Donations absolutely key lifeblood to the strike. There's a stall outside where T-shirts can be bought, and also publications and donations can be made to the Americana Solidarity Campaign.
In the junior common room.
The key elements in Ruth's life, which have to be celebrated until you almost don't have your voice left to keep celebrating them, is her commitment to activism and to intervening no matter what. So it's that intervention which is the heart of it. I disagree on the point, this is my last one, which we can go to in more discussion, in more detail, about my jumping from Libya to Mozambique. Okay, perhaps in a couple of respects I'm pushing it, but it's an explicit argument that Ruth makes in the Libya book. At the end, the last two chapters talk explicitly about the failures and the limits of nationalism, not just in the oil states of North Africa and the Middle East, but also in the context of the failure of that first wave of independence. So I'm drawing on Ruth's own arguments, and that those arguments are available on our website, mapped in detail.
Thank you, Nick. Yeah.
Yeah, I didn't speak of the U.S., but I didn't make it introduce Mindanao. But it's true the U.S. is very much operating from Mindanao because it's a key zone, including to survey Indonesia. And they are part of the fabric of the negotiations between the Moro forces and the government. And they are very much in the backseat about that. Because they want a type of agreement which allows them not to build big bases, but to operate freely with surveillance network and so on from them. But it's a bit apart from what I wanted to speak of. In limited times, in the Philippines, if you find the tribes, they are ethno-linguistic groups, defined. 13 on one, 17 for the Muslim, 13 for the Lumads. But you have, within that, you have the clans. And when you have clashes the bloody clashes are often from clans belonging to the same ethno-linguistic group, because it's where the competition is going. They are in the same territory and they will compete for the elections, which is a big business affair, the elections, in the Philippines in general and here in particular. But the definition of the tribes there is ethno-linguistic groups, where you can have some clear, you know, borders. But it's the fabric is much more complex, and the big families, the political dynasties, the clans in the Philippines are playing a very big role. Now, on the RPMM, yeah, it's true, I should have given some figures. The party underground has several thousands members underground. Now, on its reach, for example, you have in the Philippines in elections, you have a special election for party list, national list of party for small parties. And only based on Mindanao votes, because they have very little elsewhere, and mostly on their own zone, they got more than 2% of the votes, which gave you something about. Because not only you need the votes, but you need to protect the votes. Because Mindanao is the place where any party who needs votes is coming to buy the votes.
2% in Mindanao?
No, in the whole country.
Okay.
But it's only coming from Mindanao. Yeah. So only with the votes from Mindanao, which were not bought by other parties, from, you know, the process of counting disappears. It has been given to other parties here. Well, which means they have a real influence. And they have a territory. I mean, you know it. For example, it was a territory of the CPP, and still today the CPP is unable to operate in that zone because they are there. And the question is, the relationship with the CPP is very bad because CPP sentenced them to death. So the main policy is to avoid the CPP, but to forbid the CPP to get into their zone. If not, they're going to be killed. And that's the main figures of that party. All of them, they have several assassin teams on their track. All of them, they have to move from one place to the other, because one group of assassins to another can appear at any time. It's really, you are living in another world, for that, another world. Now, how they became, no, I wouldn't say how they became Trotskyists. What is Trotskyism now? Can you become Trotskyist from the Philippines where there is no Trotskyist tradition? I'm not sure you can become Trotskyist or British or whatsoever. But they joined the FI. And what is a little bit of a problem for me is that since 1977 I was going to the Philippines and I was meeting a lot of people, groups, mostly from the CPP. I knew there wouldn't be any section of the FI in the Philippines at the time of the domination of the CPP. There was no space for another group except, you know, a group of intellectuals with no roots. Then the crisis of the CPP came, but I was very rare. I wasn't going to Mindanao, basically. No other group said, knock, knock, I want to enter. And suddenly they appeared and said, knock, knock, we want to get in. I think when they splitted, they said, okay, what was the task of the party before? Now with this split, we are alone, we have to do all. So we need to have international solidarity links. And for one reason or another, because it's not natural, but I never got the exact answer, they thought it's good to get into an international. And then they said, knock, knock, we want to get in. I said, oh, you are sure you want to? Because, it, you know, for the CPP, it's a... then yes. Yeah. Okay. So now just one word about the social base. Can I just?
We'll have another chance to get to come back, I think. And I just want to open up for some more comments. He'll have another chance, don't worry. Yes.
I just want to make a comment on the national self-determination question, because I think it's very I just wanted to make a comment on the national self-determination issue, because I think it is still very much, the left is still very confused about it. I come from Sri Lanka, I live in India, and obviously in both these cases, national liberation from the British, independence from the British was absolutely necessary and correct to struggle for. But the trouble comes when you try to define what is a nation. And of course, in India, you have this two-nation theory, which came on the one hand from the Hindu nationalists, on the other hand from the Muslim League, which said Hindus and Muslims are two separate nations, they cannot live together, which is, of course, utterly reactionary. And the Communist Party of India correctly rejected that. But it then went on to say, because of the cultural differences, there was a rational call to the demand for Pakistan. And I mean, this has, of course, it led to the carnage of partition. And till today, huge problems in getting, you know, the working class of these two countries, both within each country as well as across the countries together. In Sri Lanka more recently, there has been a case of, you know, where, in fact, Trotskyist groups, which in a completely principled fashion opposed Sinhalese nationalism, later on offering maybe critical support, but nonetheless support to Tamil nationalism, which was equally equally reactionary in its own way. So I think we, while in the case of colonialism and imperialism, it is very clear about what we support, in these cases where within a country you have different cultural, linguistic, or religious groups clashing on the issue of self-determination, I think it becomes much more complex, and the left needs to look at those issues better.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of want to follow on from that and challenge it, really. And I think what I want to do is challenge the equation that's been made by some participants in the discussion between the national liberation struggle and culture. I mean, to me, culture is, you know, and it's an interesting question, but it's completely secondary. I do think that it seems to me that if you say that there's a struggle against imperialism, and then which is pure, and then there's something else that's completely secondary that misunderstands the legacy of imperialism, because the legacy of imperialism is to divide and rule. It was the British imperial rule that created partition. It used the elements of internationalism within Congress and so on, but it was British imperialism that created. And I would argue that you're wrong on Sri Lanka. Now, I'm sure you know a lot more about it than I, but I would not make an equivalent between Tamil nationalism and Sri Lankan nationalism for materialist reasons, which we don't have time to discuss now. But, you know, so I think this is interesting about what Pierre says, well, I think it's interesting about what Pierre says about Mindanao and the relationship between the Lumads and the Muslims. And for me, for example, it reminds me, and it's a very materially different situation, but to some of the political debates in Canada, more particularly in Quebec, where the dialogue between people fighting for Quebec nationalism at the same time have not respected the rights of the indigenous peoples of French Canada. So, how we reserve these things.
Okay, can I just have an indication of who else would like to speak? Okay, so we have three more speakers, four more? Okay, 1 minute each, so we have a chance to hear from our final comments. Yes?
Robert Forba. I wanted to get Leo to expand a little bit more on this question of the two-stage revolution. Particularly, I'm a little concerned that he's absolving Ruth First of a little bit too much of responsibility for the way things have unfolded. I mean, look, I would grant you, as somebody coming from the Maoist tradition, that the concept of two-stage revolution has definitely been used to justify putting off any kind of fundamental revolutionary change and setting up new national bourgeois in power in Africa. That's a big problem. But look, just reducing it to the concept of a one-stage revolution, what's happened under that concept too? Basically, it's been in the part of a lot of the pro-Moscow Soviets, communists, and the Trotskyists, has been reduced to a formula of nationalization and ignoring of a fundamental question in these countries of agrarian revolution. Okay, so you wind up with exactly what that view, that Ruth First and that SACP's view led to, which is the mess we see today. Okay, look, what did Mao Tse-tung do? These countries are fundamentally different from the heartbeat of that South African economy is not in Johannesburg or Cape Town. It's in London or Washington. You have a fundamentally different role of overthrowing imperialism in these countries.
Thank you. Yes.
No, I step back to give the minute to the speaker for more information about RPM.
Okay. Very nice.
Everyone else is on.
Okay, so what did Mao Zedong do? No, this is not the question. Leo, do you want to begin?
Oh, you're asking me the
question. Yeah, are there any more questions that or comments?
Did Gavin want to?
No, Gavin declined as well.
Okay. Well, I want to go back to a question I didn't answer before about Trotsky. I think there are certainly similarities, a great deal of similarities, and the question which has perplexed us really in the last year about the extent of her reading, you know, those closed doors that I mentioned. I don't have a definitive answer for that. I think she was part, certainly, there's an appeal at the end of Archie's article for a new left, and whether this out of Soweto a new left can emerge, and whether or not the old national liberation movements will be able to respond to that. And it's partly also an address, I think, a direct address to the editorial board of the Review of African Political Economy that Ruth helped to set up, and to Ruth herself. So there is a sense of her participating in that new left in the UK, involved in movements that were on the ground in the 60s and 70s here, as well as being an activist. I don't think she did. That's my feeling, really. I'm looking around the room to see if anyone has anything else to say. I think what's remarkable, actually, about the archive, and that we spent quite a lot of time in it, is the limits of its reading, really. And it's her papers and her books. And she was phenomenal. And the last thing I want to do is present any sort of hackish criticism, no ability to do that. The extent of her reading stretching across the continent and even further afield in the number of papers and speeches that she gave was phenomenal. And it's a crime, really, that the only book that we tried to adjust in the archive, the only book of hers which is still in print, I have to say, is probably her least significant, which is her prison memoirs of 117 days. You know, all these other great books which we still need to read aren't available. And we're hoping to make them available.
Two of them are available. Barrel of the Gun and Lydia are available on our website.
Thanks, man. I think on the question, very quickly, on the one-stage, two-stage theory, I think what I was trying to do was to say that within this one-stage theory, which by Mozambique and before, Ruth was already, you know, a very powerful advocate, that there is this separation. The separation that we have to make, which is, if you like, the one that Al Draper makes, about these two natures of socialism. One, of course, that comes from this energising self-movement, this the South African working class and their struggles that had originally inspired Ruth and continue to through her life. And also the socialism from above, which was a tradition incredibly strong across Maoist and Stalinist movements in the 60s, 50s, 60s and 70s, for example, that also informed Ruth's politics. It's that combination, the same moment often in Ruth's work, which I think is a tension that I was trying to bring out.
Thank you, Leo. Pierre.
Yeah, so to continue, in fact, the previous questions. There are industries in Mindanao, but more Davao's east side, and there are plantations, there are mines. But the mines is often savage, you know, gold rush and things, that type of difficult to organize. But the bases, the traditional bases, have been destroyed by basically the company closing shops where there were trading resistance. So One of the answers is to expand in Mindanao to other zones and to ally with other groups in the Philippines because they are Mindanaoans, nothing else. They had a first attempt of fusion which badly failed, very badly. So, chat échaudé, crâne au froid, is in French. A cat which has been burned by hot water will be afraid of cold water. But they have now good relationship with the Workers' Party in Manila, which is coming from the labor organizing of the CPP in the capital regions. But here too, shops are closed when activities of trade unions is too strong. So now on the social-based dynamics, the peasantry. Me, I have changed completely my vision of the role of the peasantry in the long run. It's part of social transformation of a new society. If not, everything we say about food sovereignty, its importance, and so on, means nothing. Everything we explain about the centrality of food sovereignty means we need peasantry in the future. So we have to think the peasant mobilizing in a long run as a part of social transformation, not as something, you know, we will get rid of as soon as possible. Secondly, migrants. So they try to organize, you know, 12 million Filipinos are working abroad. Massive. And of course, they are workers, or domestic workers, or other workers. So they try, the problem is to organize them in the host country, but they try to organize the families of those who are migrants. Well, difficult. Third, urban poor. Urban poor is very important now, including in Manila, because urban poor, you can organize the workers on the territory when you don't arrive to organize them in the factory and regain base in the factory at one point. But as a retreat, you can, first you have to organize the urban poor as such, but also it's where many workers are living. And again, it gives you a possibility to reconquer base in the companies when your relationship of forces allows it. The tribes, of course, the Muslim ethno-linguistic groups, social differentiation are very big. You have hugely rich Muslim lineages, bourgeois. So the question is class struggle in the Muslim milieu. No. The hill tribes I speak, the Lumads, for me, yeah, it's another thing. I don't know. I have no answer to that question. Can they move on their own dynamics and how? I don't know. So that's it. So an organization, one big activity is also to organize solidarity in case of war, displacement, or floods and so on. And here at that time, what they do is all the time they put Christian, Muslims, Lumads together to work together in solidarity with and whoever is hated to create these type of solidarity.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
So they're still selling these T-shirts at solidarity prices for the South African mine workers in the Junior Common Ring.
I get to the store and I make three, you know, I buy 3 minutes or something.
Yeah, I'll see you there.
Yeah, it's good. Not really cool. We'll continue this. I'm not saying we get rid of it. Successful democratic
the red one. Revolution.